Hello, this is the listening part of your exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1, you have 45 seconds to read the task. Example, speaker 0.
I was given a book about the Hubble Space Telescope when I was 12. I discovered there are galaxies millions of light years away with billions of stars and probably other planets that might be hosting life. And you know, I just thought I have to explore that.
Speaker 1.
You know, back in those days, there were only a few astronauts and they were all guys. They were all test pilots. And that was not going to include me. I liked science, I liked math, so I sort of stuck with it through college. I was working for the Army as a physicist when I saw an announcement that NASA was selecting the next group of astronauts. I thought, you know, all they can do is say no. And until they do, the dream is alive. And if they say no, you go and find some other fantasy to live.
Speaker 2.
The concept of, you know, what you could be was always engineer or physician were the kind of the things that were really pushed by families. And then things transitioned over time when I saw that there's still a limitation of what one physician can do with their time when it comes to helping people. And I saw technology as really a way to augment exponentially that drive within me to help other people. So that's kind of what led me into combining medicine with technology and space.
Speaker 3.
I was always interested in it. I always like to say that during my early years, there was no way I ever felt like something like that was for me. We were living in housing projects, single parent household. And sometimes a kid like that just kind of feels like things like space flight. You just never think that that's for you, that you don't belong in that type of community. It was actually a good decade and a half later in my life that I actually looked at myself in the mirror and thought, maybe this is something that I can endeavor to achieve someday.
Speaker 4.
At some point, maybe in first grade, that's when I said, I want to be an astronaut. I was about to graduate with my degree in math, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do with it. I had kind of gone away from thinking about space, but as I was about to graduate, I went, okay, what do I want to do now? Yeah, I did that gut check, which a lot of folks do, and say, what would really interest me? It was always space. So I said, I want to go back and be a part of our nation's space program.
Speaker 5.
My dad instilled that in me and, got me building model airplanes and got interested in science fiction and watched all the kids' science fiction programs as I was growing up. And between my dad and my mom, they pushed me and helped me get into to engineering school in California.
Speaker 6.
For me, though, it was the X-Files, just hands down, no question, because I was a little redhead girl when the X-Files was on TV. And before even, you know, I was kind of too young to watch it, to be honest, when it first started. But, you know, all the ads showed this redheaded woman in a killer pantsuit, like donning a lab coat and fighting aliens with science. So I was just, I saw her and said, you know, that's who I want to be. And just saw her like a mentor.
You have 30 seconds now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time. Speaker 1. You know, back in those days, there were only a few astronauts, and they were all guys. They were all test pilots, and that was not going to include me. I liked science, I liked math, so I sort of stuck with it through college. I was working for the Army as a physicist when I saw an announcement that NASA was selecting the next group of astronauts. I thought, you know, all they can do is say no, and until they do, the dream is alive. And if they say no, you go and find some other fantasy to live. Speaker 2.
The concept of, you know, what you could be was always engineer or physician were the kind of the things that were really pushed by families. And then things transitioned over time when I saw that there's still a limitation of what one physician can do with their time when it comes to helping people. And I saw technology as really a way to augment exponentially that drive within me to help other people. So that's kind of what led me into combining medicine with technology and space.
Speaker 3.
I was always interested in it. I always like to say that during my early years, there was no way I ever felt like something like that was for me. We were living in housing projects, single parent household, and sometimes a kid like that just kind of feels like things like space flight. You just never think that that's for you, that you don't belong in that type of community. It was actually a good decade and a half later in my life that I actually looked at myself in the mirror and thought, maybe this is something that I can endeavor to achieve someday.
Speaker 4. At some point, maybe in first grade, that's when I said, I want to be an astronaut. I was about to graduate with my degree in math, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do with it. I had kind of gone away from thinking about space, but as I was about to graduate, I went, okay, what do I want to do now? Yeah, I did that gut check, which a lot of folks do, and say, what would really interest me? It was always space. So I said, I want to go back and be a part of our nation's space program. Speaker 5.
My dad instilled that in me and, got me building model airplanes and got interested in science fiction and watched all the kids' science fiction programs as I was growing up. And between my dad and my mom, they pushed me and helped me get into to engineering school in California.
Speaker 6.
For me, though, it was the X-Files, just hands down, no question, because I was a little redhead girl when the X-Files was on TV. And before even, you know, I was kind of too young to watch it, to be honest, when it first started. But, you know, all the ads showed this redheaded woman in a killer pantsuit, like donning a lab coat and fighting aliens with science. So I saw her and said, you know, that's who I want to be. And just saw her like a mentor.
You have 30 seconds now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have 1 minute to read the task.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Green Lifestyle Programme. Today we would like to introduce Ed Begley Jr., who is equally known for two things, being a great American actor and being a decades-long committed environmentalist. His aha moment about the environment came in 1970. During the first Earth Day, he heard a speech about air pollution and it triggered his involvement in green living. So since then, he has been making incremental changes to his lifestyle. First, he began to walk. He replaced his car with a bike and relied on public transportation. Advocates of non-auto transport were thrilled by his two-wheeled ride in a tuxedo when he arrived at the Academy Awards Oscar ceremony. And he did not stop there, as every morning he pedals a stationary bicycle with a generator attached to create electricity. A 15-minute ride on it is enough to make toast. As Ed advanced in environmental protection, he realized that eating lower in the food chain would have a huge impact as well. Of course, becoming a vegetarian while traveling for work was quite challenging at first. However, Ed admits this is easy now, as you can get broccoli and veggie hot dogs everywhere. Together with his wife, he stars in the sustainable living reality show, which follows Begley in his quest to live his life with as small a carbon footprint as possible. Begley believes that, in the format of the show, everyone who watches, even people who have never thought about living a low-impact life, will be able to relate to it as well as motivated to try it. The Begleys live in their much-talked-about Platinum Standards home in Southern California. In order to popularize green buildings, they documented the construction process. The entertaining episodes of the web series highlight the Begley family's accomplishments and missteps, as well as recommendations for anyone who wants to create a green home without the sacrifice of comfort in the name of sustainability. Some people might think that the expenditures of building an eco-friendly home are very high. However, Begley insists that this is not true and promotes the idea that careful planning will keep expenses in check. Begley also has arguments for those who doubt the problem of climate change. He offers to agree to disagree on that and instead appeals to common interests. Do we agree that we want to clean up the air and water in our cities? Do we agree that we want to save money? If we can agree on those things, then a sustainable lifestyle can make a difference.
You have 45 seconds to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Lifestyle Program. Today, we would like to introduce Ed Begley Jr., who is equally known for two things, being a great American actor and being a decades-long committed environmentalist. His aha moment about the environment came in 1970. During the first Earth Day, he heard a speech about air pollution, and it triggered his involvement in green living. So since then, he has been making incremental changes to his lifestyle. First, he began to walk. He replaced his car with a bike and relied on public transportation. Advocates of non-auto transport were thrilled by his two-wheeled ride in a tuxedo when he arrived at the Academy Awards Oscar ceremony. And he did not stop there, as every morning he pedals a stationary bicycle with a generator attached to create electricity. A 15-minute ride on it is enough to make toast. As Ed advanced in environmental protection, he realized that eating lower in the food chain would have a huge impact as well. Of course, becoming a vegetarian while traveling for work was quite challenging at first. However, Ed admits this is easy now, as you can get broccoli and veggie hot dogs everywhere. Together with his wife, he stars in the sustainable living reality show, which follows Begley in his quest to live his life with as small a carbon footprint as possible. Begley believes that, in the format of the show, everyone who watches, even people who have never thought about living a low-impact life, will be able to relate to it as well as motivated to try it. The Begleys live in their much-talked-about Platinum Standards home in Southern California. In order to popularize green buildings, they documented the construction process. The entertaining episodes of the web series highlight the Begley family's accomplishments and missteps, as well as recommendations for anyone who wants to create a green home without the sacrifice of comfort in the name of sustainability. Some people might think that the expenditures of building an eco-friendly home are very high. However, Begley insists that this is not true and promotes the idea that careful planning will keep expenses in check. Begley also has arguments for those who doubt the problem of climate change. He offers to agree to disagree on that and instead appeals to common interests. Do we agree that we want to clean up the air and water in our cities? Do we agree that we want to save money? If we can agree on those things, then a sustainable lifestyle can make a difference.
You have 30 seconds now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. You have 1 minute to read the task.
I have a love-hate relationship with ants. My first apartment had ants in the walls, always waiting for their opportunity. Just a few crumbs left on the counter would undoubtedly result in a long, long line of ants, marching back and forth to collect their prize. Around the same time, a friend and I had started a consultancy, and we named it Ant Farm. Because no matter how much I hated my tiny invaders, those resilient little ants had given me a perfect metaphor. We can learn a lot from ants and how they work together. But what do an army of ants and an online encyclopedia of everything have in common? Can you hear yourself in the headphones?
I can hear myself in the headphones. Okay. Is that better?
That's Catherine Marr.
My name is Catherine Marr, and I'm the executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation, and we are the nonprofit organization that runs Wikipedia. And even if somebody writes the whole article from soup to nuts, from A to Z, it doesn't stay that whole person's article for very long. So I know that I've written a successful article when somebody else comes along and changes it.
Wikipedia is written, assembled, and governed by one of the most wide-ranging global communities you could imagine. You'd be surprised how much they have in common with ants. This is Clint Pennick.
My name is Clint Pennick, and I am an assistant research professor in the Biomimicry Center at Arizona State University. I've been interested in ants since I was pretty young. So as someone who grew up in the South, I had fire ant colonies in my yard. They build these mounds out of dirt. And what's always sort of interesting about it, when you brush away part of their mound, you see all these ants rush out. They're behaving kind of hectic and crazy. When you watch any individual in that colony, it seems like they're kind of doing stuff that's not adding to the whole. They're not this well-oiled machine. And so if you stare at them for a few minutes as a kid, I would get pretty bored. And so then I would walk away and go do something else. But then you come back an hour later and they've perfectly rebuilt the structure. So what happens is the ants notice that something has damaged the area. They send out an alarm pheromone, which recruits a bunch of other ants that come. They look around. They were like, oh, I'm standing outside. I'm not sheltered in my nest. And what they do is they start looking for grains of sand or dirt, and they just start piling them up randomly. The next ants that come along, as they're grabbing a piece of dirt, they look at the environment and they say, oh, well, there's already a pile starting over here to my right. I'm just going to add to it. And so they add to that pile.
Let's just note that most Wikipedia articles come into the world in a similar fashion. An editor starts a pile of facts, sentences, and citations, and refines it. As they begin to shape it into something coherent, other contributors become aware of their work, and then they join in to contribute their own elements until it becomes a full-blown article.
You have 45 seconds to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Have a love-hate relationship with ants. My first apartment had ants in the walls, always waiting for their opportunity. Just a few crumbs left on the counter would undoubtedly result in a long, long line of ants marching back and forth to collect their prize. Around the same time, a friend and I had started a consultancy, and we named it Ant Farm. Because no matter how much I hated my tiny invaders, those resilient little ants had given me a perfect metaphor. We can learn a lot from ants and how they work together. But what do an army of ants and an online encyclopedia of everything have in common? Can you hear yourself in the headphones?
I can hear myself in the headphones. Okay. Is that better?
That's Catherine Marr.
My name is Catherine Marr, and I'm the executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation, and we are the nonprofit organization that runs Wikipedia. And even if somebody writes the whole article from soup to nuts, from A to Z, it doesn't stay that whole person's article for very long. So I know that I've written a successful article when somebody else comes along and changes it.
Wikipedia is written, assembled, and governed by one of the most wide-ranging global communities you could imagine. You'd be surprised how much they have in common with ants. This is Clint Pennock.
My name is Clint Pennock, and I am an assistant research professor in the Biomimicry Center at Arizona State University. I've been interested in ants since I was pretty young. So as someone who grew up in the South, I had fire ant colonies in my yard. They build these mounds out of dirt. And what's always sort of interesting about it, when you brush away part of their mound, you see all these ants rush out. They're behaving kind of hectic and crazy. When you watch any individual in that colony, it seems like they're kind of doing stuff that's not adding to the whole. They're not this well-oiled machine. And so if you stare at them for a few minutes, as a kid, I would get pretty bored. And so then I would walk away and go do something else. But then you come back an hour later and they've perfectly rebuilt the structure. So what happens is the ants notice that something has damaged the area. They send out an alarm pheromone, which recruits a bunch of other ants that come. They look around. They were like, oh, I'm standing outside. I'm not sheltered in my nest. And what they do is they start looking for grains of sand or dirt, and they just start piling them up randomly. The next ants that come along, as they're grabbing a piece of dirt, they look at the environment and they say, oh, well, there's already a pile starting over here to my right. I'm just going to add to it. And so they add to that pile.
Let's just note that most Wikipedia articles come into the world in a similar fashion. An editor starts a pile of facts, sentences, and citations, and refines it. As they begin to shape it into something coherent, other contributors become aware of their work, and then they join in to contribute their own elements until it becomes a full-blown article.
You have 30 seconds now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.